Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Up first, our week in review. The Dems debate in Vegas, Markey and Kennedy face off in Boston, and a Lowell state rep is arrested for allegedly misusing campaign funds.
This was a systematic pattern of theft and fraud going back to at least 2014. Nangle accomplished it in part using people close to him.
Plus, border agents with SWAT team training now patrol Boston. We'll take your calls on all of it in our Week in Review. 1-800-423-8255. Also today, he was part of one of the greatest moments in sports history.
U.S. team is depending a little bit too much now on Jim Craig. He's making too many good saves.
Arruzioni! Yes! Mike Arruzioni!
Winthrop's Mike Arruzioni reflects on the miracle on ice 40 years later. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. Friday, Week in Review. Beginning with an explosive stretch of politics, we had the candidates on the presidential debate stage.
A billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg.
The one thing that I'm really worried about, embarrassed about, was how it turned out with Stop and Frisk.
Now, this isn't about how it turned out. This is about what it was designed to do to begin with.
You know what, Mr. Bloomberg? It wasn't you who made all that money. Maybe your workers played some role in that as well.
Mayor Buttigieg really has a slogan that was thought up by his consultants. And Amy's plan is even less. It's like a post-it note. Insert plan here.
Are you trying to say that I'm dumb? Or are you mocking me here, Pete?
I'm saying that you shouldn't trivialize
I made an error. People sometimes forget names.
I can't think of a ways that would make it easier for Donald Trump to get reelected than listening to this conversation. It's ridiculous.
We also had the first showdown between Markey and Kennedy for Senate.
On the big issues of today, the challenges of today, I've not only been leading, but I've been delivering with legislation which passes, which protects the people of Massachusetts and the whole country.
This is not a swing state, and this is not a swing seat. There is a special opportunity and obligation that comes with it. Because voting the right way and filing the right bill, Mitch McConnell doesn't care.
And a Lowell state rep arrested for allegedly misusing campaign funds. Here's U.S. Attorney Andrew Lellick.
Nangle used this money to, among other things, pay golf club dues, rent cars for travel to casinos, and to buy flowers for his girlfriend. If the allegations in the indictment are true, it is safe to say that Representative Nangle has violated the public trust.
So, as we head into election season, where are we in presidential and local politics? Give us a call. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me in Studio 3 this week is Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, and an activist and organizer. Reverend Mariama, good to see you. Welcome back.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Also with us is Charlie Chipio, principal of Chipio Strategies and a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute. Charlie, welcome back to you as well.
Great. Good to be here. Thank you.
All right. We got a lot of ground to cover. Let's start with that last thing that we heard about Representative David Nangle. He's pleaded guilty or not guilty to 28 felony counts in U.S. District Court, and he faces federal charges including wire and bank fraud for allegedly spending more than $70,000 in campaign funds to bankroll his personal debts and sustain his gambling habit. His lawyer says there's nothing to this. They're just allegations. Reverend Mariama, what's your reaction to this case?
Well, unfortunately, from what I've read, it sounds like he's got a real problem. And the reality is that when people have an addiction, they're willing to do a lot of things to feed that addiction. And that's what it sounds like. It felt a little like maybe he should plead and figure out how he gets better and works through his addiction. But, you know, I don't know. I haven't seen all the documents, but it seemed pretty damning what I've read.
No, but that was my reaction as well. It certainly seems like the issue here is addiction, that, you know, we have somebody who is suffering from an addiction and needs help.
Well, should the view of that affect the way we think about the case, though, because we've talked about this a lot with drug cases, for example. Yeah. We've started to think about those maybe a little bit less as a society, as a criminal issue. I mean, not when people are dealing hard drugs, but we think about it as a public health issue more and more these days. Any sympathy in this case, Mervyn Mariama, if that's what's going on here?
Well, I think there's two things that we have to think about at the same time. One is that he has betrayed the public trust and broken the law, and that's one thing that should be dealt with. And then the question is how does he move forward and get healthy? And as I say in many cases, I'm a person who wonders if jail is the right option for a lot of challenges that people have. And so if you're asking me what I think is best in terms of him getting to a better place and repaying his debt to society, that's one thing. But it does seem really clear that he has broken the law, and I think that needs to be addressed. And he's broken the public trust, and he's in a role where people gave him that money not for personal use. And so that has to be figured out.
So Nangle, again, has pleaded not guilty to those 28 counts. His attorney, William Connolly, has issued a statement calling Nangle a good man who has proudly served his district as a state representative, and that the charges against David are nothing more than allegations. A particular ironic twist to this, too, is that he's been in the legislature for more than 20 years, and he's on the Ethics Committee.
He was the chairman of the Ethics Committee
right.
at one time.
So he's stepped down from those leadership positions, not stepping down from his seat. Here's what U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling had to say about the case, though. He is not buying the explanation that this is just an accusation.
This was not a momentary lapse of judgment or a technical foul. This was a systematic pattern of theft and fraud going back to at least 2014. Nangle accomplished it in part using people close to him.
Charlie Chip, you have noticed that we hear that from Andrew Lelling a lot in these public corruption cases lately, where he kind of sounds like he says, well, this person didn't act alone, kind of opens the door that maybe more charges against other people right. could be coming. Did you read that same way?
Yeah, I mean, I did. Look, I think that clearly that was much of the approach he took in Varsity Blues, and clearly it's worked for him, so I'm not
Varsity
surprised.
Blues being that
the college admissions
college
scandal.
Admissions, right.
Said the guy who spent 8 years doing college admissions. But yes, I think that's right. The other thing that I was very taken by was Nangle's attorney. The fact that he said, it's interesting to me as a sort of never actually having practiced attorney, that he said these are just allegations, but didn't say my client is not guilty of these charges.
Yeah.
He said we're going to fight these charges,
yeah,
but yeah.
I thought that was very interesting.
It was carefully worded.
Yes.
I mean, to be honest with you, I'd feel better if he just would admit
yes.
and get on the path to recovery. I think the reality is the more you dig in and claim innocence, the more you sort of treat us like we're kind of stupid yeah. and then we get upset that you're just lying.
Well, right. Big picture here, though. I'm wondering from both of you. I mean, should we treat this as kind of an isolated incident? Because I'm also thinking about some of the other public corruption cases we've seen on Beacon Hill. Think about all the speakers, Sal DeBasi, Tom Fenner, yeah. and Charles Flaherty, all convicted of felonies. I mean, is there a broader problem on Beacon Hill?
Oh, look, absolutely. There's a broader problem. And it's not just on Beacon Hill. I mean, it's just that especially at these times when what's happening nationally is pretty horrific, in my view. I think that we have got to try to protect any shred of public trust in our government mm-hmm. that we can. I yeah. think it's such a particularly important issue right now.
Reverend Mariama?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the reality is, to be honest with you, as I looked at this, I started to say, is some of this because we just have too much incumbency? Is it that over a period of time, your ability to stay focused and an ethical starts to fall away? I don't know, but I think at the core of this, there does seem to be a much deeper systemic problem that these kinds of things happen every year, every couple of years. Some guy goes down for these kinds of ethic violations. And so I do think it's time for us to have a deeper conversation about the larger environment that seems to lead far too many people in this direction.
Maybe term limits. I mean, it does seem that as you stay on and your power grows, the temptation could increase as well.
Mm-hmm.
Listeners, again, if you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I want to move on to another local politics story from the week, though. We also had the first televised Senate debate in that race between Joe Kennedy III and incumbent Senator Ed Markey. They were facing off on Channel 2, and here's a flavor of what it sounded like.
Congress has not, the federal government has not, passed meaningful gun violence legislation in decades. When it comes to the environment, the last transformative law that was signed into the bill that was signed into law was signed by Richard Nixon.
Yes, can I interrupt? Honestly, that's just not accurate. The last meaningful gun safety legislation passed in the last week of December of 2019, when my bill was actually signed by Donald Trump to begin research at the CDC that had been blocked for 25 years by the NRA. And I might say, the last environmental law, the big one, well, that was my law as well. It was the 2007 law that doubled the fuel economy standards. It's the single largest reduction of greenhouse gases of any law ever passed in any country in the world.
So, Charlie Shapiro, that was one of the key exchanges from that night. We pointed out earlier that Ed Markey sort of embellished his environmental record there a little bit, those emissions standards.
Has been known to happen among our elected officials.
They increased 40%. They didn't double. And it's worth noting that we haven't met those targets. But nevertheless, who do you think came out on top? I mean, did he successfully beat back those criticisms from Joe Kennedy?
I do think that he outperformed Kennedy in that debate. I would say that. I think Joe Kennedy's issue and Joe Kennedy's problem here is that ultimately it reminds me a little bit of when his uncle was asked in 1980 why he was running for president, and he sort of stammered on for a long time. You know, it's the same kind of thing
when he was challenging
here,
Jimmy Carter.
When he was challenging Jimmy Carter, it's a little bit of the same kind of thing here, where it's coming up with a real sort of raison d'être for why he's challenging somebody with whom he agrees on virtually every issue. It's tough.
Well, let me just play a little bit of that, because you're right. This was one of the key questions that surely he knew he was going to face, and he faced it right off the top. Why are you running against a progressive stalwart who shares many of your same policy positions? And here's how Kennedy answered.
This is about making sure that, one, you are a constant presence in Massachusetts, making sure that the people across our state know that you're fighting for them and know what to care about. You have to ensure that you're bringing everything you possibly can to restore power to a Democratic Party so that we can actually advance the causes we care about and protect the people we care about.
So, Reverend Mariama White Hammond, is that a clear and convincing case for why he is in this race against an otherwise allied politician like Ed Markey?
Well, after this, I went around and called a few people, and I'd say no. The folks that I talked to said no. I think the reality is that not that many people are paying attention to it, and the people that are paying attention to it are the politicos, the people that are going to volunteer and knock on doors. So I called a few of them, asked them what they thought. Ultimately, a lot of them said, or I should say the three out of the four that I talked to said, in a time where we should be focusing on fighting Trump, why is he jumping in and creating a contested election? Mm. So I think personally, I felt like it was a slight wash in terms of, I think each of them had good moments, bad moments. But I think Kennedy had to answer that key question, why are you in it? And from the folks I talked to, no, they didn't feel like that was clear. And so from that perspective, I think he lost because he was the one who had to – that was his one job for that night. And if that's – people walked away feeling like that didn't happen, then that's not good for him.
We're talking politics with Reverend Mariama White Hammond and Charlie Chipio, principal of Chipio Strategies. And you can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Again, the number is 1-800-423-TALK. Jerry is on 495. Jerry, hope you're abiding by those new hands-free rules, but go ahead.
I'll plead the fifth on that. but I would say that both the first item about Representative Nangle or Senator Nangle or whoever and the debate raised the issue that your guests, I think, accurately point out. They've called it incumbency or maybe the need for term limits, but I would say it's because we live in a one-party state. It's like we live in Bulgaria before the Iron Curtain came down. We really only have one party to choose from here, so it doesn't matter whether it's Markey or Kennedy. And if you never are being held accountable by the voters, because if we live in a one-party state, then of course you're going to be corrupt. It's inherent.
Got it. Jerry, thanks for the ring.
By definition, corrupt.
Jerry, I'm just going to grab it back because I want to give Susan a chance to go ahead. Susan is in Brighton. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm tired of government corruption, and I think I can't remember his name, but he was in the ethics committee, that who you were talking about.
Nangle,
before.
Yes. David Nangle.
Nangle, yes. And I think he should get a lot of punishment because this is happening too much. I heard that something happened to Lowell, and no one's being punished. I think he really should lose his job.
All right, Susan, thanks for the ring. Let me try to use that to spin into our final subject in the politics department while we have some time, which is the presidential debate that we saw. And we heard some complaints there's sort of money in politics here and it's corrupting influence. In this case, it's literal corruption. But we've also have seen a lot of Democrats complaining about the role that money plays in the Democratic presidential primary with Michael Bloomberg, a Medford native, according to some, just buying his way into this election with a lot of airwaves. We saw him make his debut on the debate stage, Reverend Mariama. What did you think of the way he fared in Nevada this week?
Well, it was pretty disappointing. I was joking with a friend.
Not for
maybe
his opponents, it was.
Well, no.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the question is, why would you fight so hard to get on that stage and then perform like that? And maybe it's that ultimately, like, when you have that much money and power, maybe there are not enough people around you that hold you accountable. But it was... it was pretty bad.
I don't think he wanted to get on that stage. In other words, I think in his perfect world, he would have been on ballot in all these states, and he would have just done his rallies and his ads and everything. I don't think he wants to be on the debate stage, but he's got to do it.
Of course, his chief antagonist, of course, was Elizabeth Warren, our own senator. She has reported that she hauled in $5 million after that debate on a strong performance. We saw Amy Klobuchar sort of vault back into prominence after a strong debate performance in New Hampshire. I mean, could we see Warren pull off similar comeback kid moment, Charlie Chipio, in Nevada this weekend?
Look, I think that may be the case. I think the one thing that's kind of complicating that for Senator Warren is the fact that there's so much early voting now, and so many of the folks in Nevada, for example, had already voted by the time that debate happened. So I think that that's sort of a new wrinkle in this that's going to sort of limit that impact a little bit. But, I think she certainly will win some votes as a result of it.
Yeah, and I think that I agree with Charlie around the Nevada piece. And so I think that ultimately, I think her main target might have needed to be South Carolina. And I'm not there on the ground to hear what people are saying right now. But the question for me is, was she able to move, particularly black voters in South Carolina, many of whom are a little shaken by Biden's poor performance? So I don't know. We'll see. I have to know it is a little challenging with Iowa and New Hampshire, two of the sort of whitest and not some of the most populous states, sort of setting the agenda. I'm really hoping to see what happens in Nevada and in South Carolina.
Yeah, a lot of delegates, right, still
right,
out there.
Right. So, I do agree, and I think, this question of whether or not Elizabeth Warren can come back, I don't know, right? But I do think... she did make a good point that only two states have voted so far, and they are not states that are most representative of this country. So let's see what happens.
All right. We're running short on time in politics, but I do want to give a couple more callers a chance to go ahead. Deborah is in Winchester. We are short on time, Deborah, but go ahead.
I just wanted to comment that one of the things that aggravates me about Kennedy challenging Markey is that Markey's a senior senator. So he has, higher priority for his committee appointment. Has more of the ability to negotiate with other senators in terms of getting bills passed and his agenda forward. So I don't understand why Kennedy, who has similar philosophies, is pushing Markey out when that would really be detrimental to Massachusetts.
Got it. Deborah, thanks for the ring. It's a good point. Of course, Ed Markey, with the seniority that he has, would argue that perhaps he can be more effective, whereas Joe Kennedy would be kind of starting on the ground floor in the Senate. Let's take one more before the break. Jim is in Lincoln. Go ahead, Jim.
Yeah, contrarian to that, my understanding is I love that Kennedy's involved, and I love that he's focused on Massachusetts. We're so focused on this national debate against Trump. In the Democratic Party, some young, vibrant representation is exactly what we need in Washington. That's my point.
All right, Jim, thanks for the ring. Yeah, so Charlie Chipio, real quick, I mean, that was part of Kennedy's argument. He was sort of knocking Markey for spending so much time in Washington. He was saying, you need an energetic senator who's going to be on the ground right here, and that's me.
Well, look, I mean, the reality is that I would say the same thing if it was Republicans. But going back to the gentleman who talked about the one-party state, it is a one-party state. In the big picture, I don't think it makes a dime worth of difference whether it's Kennedy or Markey. And I think that's why a lot of the political folks are a little frustrated that Kennedy's doing this.
We're discussing major headlines with Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester, and Charlie Chipio, principal of Chipio Strategies. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. Let's turn now to the verdict in a high-profile civil suit against Boston Children's Hospital. This is the malpractice case brought by the family of Justina Pelletier. A jury ruled yesterday that the hospital was not negligent in its treatment of Pelletier. To set the table for our panelists, I want to bring in WBUR Common Health reporter Angus Chen, who was in the courtroom for the verdict and throughout much of the five-week trial. Hey there, Angus.
Hey, Callum.
So this Pelletier saga was a long one. It's been playing out for years in public. Remind us what the case is all about. Why did the Pelletier family sue Boston Children's Hospital?
Yeah, Justina Pelletier and her parents sued the hospital and several doctors who were involved in her care for two things: civil rights violations and medical malpractice. But like you said, this has been a long story, and it really begins back in 2013 when Justina Pelletier comes to Boston Children's Hospital for the first time. She arrives in the emergency room in the middle of the night, and she's not responsive. She can't really talk. She can't eat. She can't drink. She can't walk. And doctors are seeing these very troubling neurological symptoms, as well as some severe abdominal pain. Then she's in the hospital for, you know, a few days, and during that time, doctors are noticing a few things that really start to worry them. And that makes them think, could her mental health actually be causing some of her symptoms?
Huh. So what made them think the problem might be at least partially mental? I mean, what signs were they seeing?
Yeah, the first doctor to start to notice this was Jurianne Peters. He was the main doctor coordinating her care at that time. And he did a bunch of neurological tests and just couldn't pinpoint an underlying medical or neurological problem for why she was the way she was. That kind of makes him think maybe this condition is partially psychological. And then he notices that when Justina's by herself, she's more lively. She seems to be doing better than when she's with her parents. When she's with her parents, she slumps more, she's less responsive, and generally seems to be doing worse. Then he calls up the doctors who were involved in her care in the past, and they tell him that they've seen the same thing. They're sort of thinking, hey, maybe there's some kind of abuse, some kind of medical abuse or neglect happening here. With that in mind, they kind of suggest this treatment plan that the parents absolutely hate. And that's partially because it involves a lot of psychiatric care. And the response is to try to take Justina out of Boston Children's Hospital 4 days after she was admitted. And when Dr. Peters, the neurologist who was overseeing this care, learns about this, you know, he gets a page about like a couple blocks away from the hospital. He becomes alarmed. He kind of panics. This is what he told the jury when he was recalling that moment.
I literally ran to the hospital. We said that it was not safe and we would not allow her to be discharged at that point in time, and we notified them that the 51A had been filed.
A 51A is a report of child abuse or neglect, and he doesn't believe that Justina can be cared for outside of a hospital. Her medical needs are so great that she really needs to have inpatient care inside Boston Children's. So Child Services gets involved, and they eventually take custody of Justina Pelletier.
And this becomes a key point in the case, as I understand it, because the parents believe that they're being denied their basic rights to make decisions about their child's health care. And then as it goes forward, Angus, right, Justina Pelletier is put in a locked psychiatric ward at Boston Children's Hospital. The Department of Children and Families is involved, as you mentioned. And so she and her parents are suing over this treatment. How was she treated once she got there?
Yeah, that was a really emotional day in the courtroom where Justina Pelletier took the stand. She's 21 now. You know, every day she was in there in her wheelchair, and she goes up to the stand and starts recalling what she experienced when she was 14 years old.
It hurt me so much. It made me worse. I kept getting weaker.
Some of the things that happened to Justina in there do sound pretty difficult. She said that she'd pass out after some of these procedures and sweat profusely. And she just felt horribly isolated, being away from her family, being unable to talk to her family for more than, you know, 20 minutes on the phone a week or see them for more than an hour a week.
So how is Children's Hospital reacting to the verdict?
The hospital said they felt vindicated in their statement. They said, quote, "The jury's decision affirms what Boston Children's Hospital has always believed, that our clinicians provided Justina Pelletier high-quality, compassionate care and always acted in the best interest of her health and well-being."
Boy, I mean, if we step back, Angus, this had to be a really hard case for both sides. I mean, you got parents who say their daughter was effectively taken away from them. You've got doctors who are worried about their careers and their reputations. I mean, what was it like in court?
Yeah, I think it was really emotional for everyone involved. I spoke with Dr. Alice Newton. She's one of the defendants, and she told me the experience was just really isolating, having to sit in the courtroom, you know, every day and not see her friends and colleagues like you would at a normal day at work. And for the family, they have to watch people hash out super intimate, private medical details of their lives and relive some terrible moments. At one point, I was talking to Linda, Justina Pelletier's mom, and she said that it's just been the hardest thing.
All right. That's WBUR Common Health reporter Angus Chen. Angus, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Alan.
Okay, let's pick up the conversation there with our Week in Review panelists. Charlie Chipio is a principal of Chipio Strategies, and we're also joined by Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester. Reverend Mariama, what was your reaction to the verdict?
I mean, to be honest with you, I felt like there was a lot of anguish on both sides. I have paid a little bit of attention to this. My parents are in the medical profession, and I've spent my fair share of time at Children's Hospital when my mom used to go on rounds. So I think, it seemed really challenging. I have also had the experience when I ran a youth program of parents who have very great intentions for their kids, but also are reluctant to consider that their child might have a mental health challenge. And so I saw a lot of strands in this. Ultimately, I think, our court system is innocent until proven guilty, and it sounds very clear that the jurors felt like the proof was not clear that Children's Hospital was to blame or had done something improper. And I do think there was a possibility had Children's been, held liable, that it could have had a chilling effect for folks who were trying to really support children and young people. So to me, it was challenging and not so cut and dry, but it was clear that there was a lot of pain on all sides by people who definitely disagreed about how this got down.
Yeah, I think that's a good synopsis. And Charlie Chipio, I mean, as Mariama said, I mean, there was a real precedent to be set here, right?
Yes.
I mean, what's the degree to which parents should be able to make decisions about their children's health care versus when do you allow the experts to kind of take charge?
Right.
I mean,
right.
What do you think that the legacy of this case
right.
will be?
Well, I mean, look, I think, and again, I don't have the kind of personal impact. I'm just sort of reading about it with far away and long ago sort of legal training. Two things about this case stuck out to me. One is that what a long history of sort of being very problematic it appeared that the parents had to a whole variety of medical providers. The second thing was that in preparing for this case, the best that the family could come up with in terms of expert witnesses were a philosopher, a rural ER doctor who was retired, and essentially a professional witness who'd never treated children.
Yeah, and a juror who spoke to the Boston Globe said that was a really key in their decision.
And so I don't know. I mean, when I put those things together, my sense is that the jury came to the right decision. And, you're right. I think that there would have been big precedent set here in terms of that would have made, if it's possible, hospitals and other healthcare providers even more sort of aware, shall we say, of litigation possibilities than they are today.
Yeah, so. For as complicated as the case seemed, the jury took only 6 hours to deliberate. So at least in their minds, there seemed to be a clear right thing to do. I do want to get to one more local story in our Week in Review, and that is that about immigration officials deploying an elite tactical special agent group to sanctuary cities, including Boston. A number of these specially trained officers and agents are from U.S. Customs and Border Protection, and they're here working with local ICE officials, that's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. Mayor Marty Walsh is not thrilled about this. Here's what he had to say earlier in the week.
I quite don't understand why you would take somebody from the southern border if you're so concerned about immigration into the country, take agents off the southern border and put them into selected cities around the United States of America. I don't quite understand that rationale at all.
So if you'd like to weigh in on this as well, the number is 1-800-423-8255. Again, that's 1-800-423-TALK. Reverend Mariama, what do you make about Mayor Marty Walsh's statement right there? He says, if you've got this supposed border crisis, why are you taking agents away from there and putting them in sanctuary cities?
The strategy seems concerning to me. And, I want to be transparent. I have helped to lead a sanctuary ministry where we have taken people in who are in danger of deportation and they lived in the church that I was serving. So I'm not totally neutral on this question. It does seem rather political. I read what they said about why they're here, and I couldn't understand what problem they're exactly addressing, even from their perspective. So I'll say, and I think maybe other people feel differently, it seemed like a bit of a bully tactic against cities that maybe don't align with the administration's understanding of how we should handle
immigration. You have a future in diplomacy.
Well, if I may, I'll try to summarize what the explanation that we've gotten, and immigration officials have said, look, we're not getting cooperation from local law enforcement like we used to. They don't enforce these detainers. These are requests that they would make to local law enforcement. Mm-hmm. We were otherwise going to release this person, but would you please hold on to him or her for another couple of days until we can go pick them up? And then we've also heard just this week from ICE's Boston field office director. This is Todd Lyons speaking with WBUR. And he says this is the goal of having these special officers here in Boston.
It's one thing we focus on is going after the worst of the worst. Those are the cases we're actually going after. And I think when you see those egregious crimes, you can see why we do have more specialized trained officers with us to go out there. High-risk vehicle stops, clearing buildings. So those are the type of officers that are being deployed, not because of their special skills, but they're used to dealing in an urban environment.
So that's the acting director of ICE's Boston field office, Todd Lyons, saying, Charlie Shipp, you know, that this is not for, you know, the everyday stuff. We're going after the worst of the worst. Does that make sense?
No, I don't buy that at all. And I'll tell you why. A couple of things. One is a lot of the people that they're going after here are people who have only who are not convicted, who are only being accused of these things. Mm-hmm. Their cases haven't even been decided.
In some cases, accused of violent crimes, though.
Yes, absolutely.
But most of the people who are accused of violent crimes are not what we're talking about.
Right.
Because they're often not released, right? They're often
already
being held.
The other thing is that the Boston police are not releasing people who are accused of killing people.
Sure.
Where they might be talking about when he talks about the traffic stop is immigrants who are stopped and don't have a license. Well, they don't have a license because they can't get a license because they are undocumented. I don't think we should be keeping those folks in our jails. Yeah. They are not dangerous.
Look, I have two overall thoughts on this. One is the irony of it during the same week in which we are Bloomberg is undergoing, you know, rightfully, I think, what he's facing because of his stop and frisk policies. Mm-hmm. We have SWAT teams coming up from the border here to take care of these illegal immigrants. But I think that the bigger picture here is in the universe of challenges and problems that we have in Massachusetts. This is so far down the list. Not that it's not a problem, not that there are not issues here, but this is entirely political. Because, look, this is not what ought to be keeping anybody in Massachusetts awake at night. We have much bigger problems than this.
So, again, the local field office is saying that they've already used these agents to make a couple of roundups this week. And the Boston Herald reports that the two individuals who were picked up are, in fact, charged with violent crimes. But, again, as you said, it's their only charges. And, Reverend Mariamma, as you pointed out, if local law enforcement thought that they were truly dangerous, perhaps they wouldn't have released them in the first place.
I mean, I want to know what these offenses are. Are they people that got into, you know, a fight at a club? Like, what are the offenses?
Well, the one is assault with intent to rape and indecent assault and battery. And then the other is charges of threatening to bomb and assault with a dangerous weapon, along with multiple charges of OUI. Those are the two men. Mm-hmm. So that's the types of charges that we're talking about in those particular cases.
But again, it's not that those aren't important. You know, those aren't serious charges. But, you know, we're talking about two people and just the degree that all this sort of undocumented stuff, the attention it's getting. I mean, I understand in Texas or in Arizona or something, but this is not a big issue here. This attention is unwarranted.
And, of course, the concern is what's the trade-off? You get a couple of dangerous people, but do you drive other people underground and minimize cooperation with local law enforcement?
Exactly.
Before we run out of time, I do want to get to our hubbubs. Those are the sort of brief stories or events this week that may have slipped below the headlines, but nevertheless deserve our attention and are perhaps a little bit on the lighter side. Charlie Chipio, let me start with you. What are you bringing to the table today?
Well, look, in the midst of all this sort of bad news and political madness that we've just been talking about the last few minutes, there is at least one antidote that we can count on. The author of the annual State of the Wine Industry report says that in 2020, U.S. consumers will see the best wine retail values in 20 years. The reason is the classic combination of rising supply and falling demand. Northern California vineyards have been planting thousands of acres of new vines in recent years and employed more efficient harvesting methods. And at the same time they've been doing that, demand for wine has leveled off and has actually dropped for the first time in 25 years. Adding to the good news, it takes up to 5 years from initial planting to the time when wine comes to market. So it's likely to be several years before the winemakers can adjust the supply and stabilize the prices.
Interesting.
So there you go.
Reverend Mariama, maybe there's a good deal to be had on communion here.
I know. I'm saying maybe we should upgrade. Well, you know, we are going into Ash Wednesday, and, you know, I'm in my preparation. And I saw a really great article in the Washington Post by Jeff Smith, and he talked about how the Amish decide which technologies they're going to use and which ones they're not.
Oh.
And
what's
it was
the
interesting.
Technique?
Well, they said that, you know, they would look at a technology and see if it would bring benefit. And then the key question, will it bring the community together more or less? So there was a guy who wanted to buy a tool that would help him harvest hay faster. And they decided no, because now he has to reach out to people and bring them together to cut the hay. And that gives them time to be together and work together. And if he used this machine, he'd be able to get it all done himself and he wouldn't have to rely on folks to do it. And so this idea of what brings us together, I'm encouraging my folks to think about what they're fasting for Lent. And I say, you know, candy could be great, but maybe, just maybe, Facebook or, you know, a little less texting.
Yeah, maybe give up those conveniences that sort of prevent you from getting together
exactly.
with people.
So I said, hey, we should all learn something from the Amish.
All right. Well, I love those two stories. Thank you very much to both of you for joining us for our Week in Review. That was Reverend Mariama White-Hammond, pastor at the New Roots AME Church in Dorchester and an activist and organizer. Always good to see you, Mariama.
It's great to be here.
Our thanks also to Charlie Chipio, principal of Chipio Strategies and a senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute. Charlie, good to see you.
Good to see you. My pleasure.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. 40 years ago tomorrow, a young team of amateur U.S. hockey players took on Goliath and won. The setting? Lake Placid, New York. The Giant? A Soviet Union team that had won 4 straight Olympic gold medals. On February 22nd, 1980, with 10 minutes left in a semifinal matchup played in the shadow of the Cold War, Winthrop native Mike Ruzioni hammered a loose puck past the Soviet goaltender and into the back of the net, giving Team USA its first lead of the game.
The U.S. team is depending a little bit too much now on Jim Craig. He's making too many good saves.
Ruzioni! Yes! Mike Ruzioni! Now we've got Bedlam.
Oh, as the final minutes, then seconds, melted away, play-by-play announcer Al Michaels delivered a call for the ages.
11 seconds. You've got 10 seconds. The countdown going on right now. Morrow, up to Schultz. 5 seconds left in the game.
Over.
You believe in miracles? Yes!
Unbelievable.
The miracle on ice, as the upset victory became known, is one of the greatest moments in American sports, especially since Team USA went on to win a gold medal. We caught up with team captain Mike Ruzioni in his Boston University office, and I just had to ask, Mike, do you believe in miracles?
I was talking to Al Michaels yesterday, and Al and I have played golf over the years together, and every time we play and we're walking up a fairway, somebody yells, "Hey, Mike, hey, Al, do you believe in miracles?" And Al and I just look at each other and just shake our head. So, yes, I do.
Well, so do we. And, boy, what a golf group to be in on. I'm sure that people would kill to join with that pairing. Mike, could you just take us back to that day in Lake Placid 40 years ago? I mean, what do you remember? I imagine it's just like yesterday.
Yeah, you know, I deal with it quite a bit. So, you know, I think it's just a very proud moment for me and my teammates to know that we were part of a moment that we didn't know touched the lives of so many people in such a great way. So I think, you know, you kind of take great pride looking back on not only was it a great event for us, but a great event for our country.
The game itself, of course, was compelling, but there was so much buildup and anticipation to it. Did you guys feel that, or were you able to sort of insulate yourselves as a team and just focus on the hockey?
We focused on the hockey game. We didn't know what was going on around us. We weren't allowed to talk to the media, so we didn't know what was happening other than what was going on in Lake Placid and maybe at home with our family and friends. So that was a good thing because we were shocked by it when we got out into the country and realized that this thing was pretty huge. So, you know, we were in a little village in Lake Placid and pretty much kept to ourselves and the task at hand was to play hockey. It had nothing to do, you know, over the years I've always heard, you know, the political climate that was never discussed, never talked about. To us, it was a hockey game.
You've come to appreciate that, though, I'm sure, over the years, right, as you've read
yeah,
and understood the significance.
I think the people that I've met over the years, the stories that they've had to tell me, you know, I've had people come up to me and just start crying because the game meant so much to them for whatever particular reason that might be. So, yeah, you take great pride knowing that, you know, you touched so many people's lives in a positive way. And, you know, after it was over, we realized that the country was looking for something to feel good about, and it happened to be us.
For folks who've forgotten or perhaps even weren't alive, remind them just what you were up against. I mean, this Soviet team was a colossus at the time.
Yeah, they were considered the best team in the world. You know, I don't know, they never played Edmonton Oilers, although they did beat most and almost all the NHL teams they played, and then they beat NHL All-Stars by a score of 6-0. So, you know, when they were professionals, we were college kids. Our average, we the youngest Olympic team we'd ever put on the ice. We were by far the youngest Olympic team in the tournament. And, you know, it was an incredible upset. It was a great victory. But, you know, for us, like I said, it was a hockey game. But for the country, it was something greater.
It was a national and international story on a lot of levels. It was also a real Boston story, right? I mean, there was a lot of Boston boys on that team.
Yeah, well, Boston University boys. The four of us were from BU, Jim Craig, Jack O'Callaghan, and Dave Silk. And, you know, predominantly the most, 90% of the team was Minnesota kids. But we always say the most important ones were the four guys from BU.
Well, of course. I mean, you and Jim Craig alone, right? I mean, those are the two the people I think remember most fondly. Do you and Jim keep up, or we're always wonder? I think when these anniversaries come around, do you and the boys ever see each other?
Yeah, we're going to be together this weekend. We're excited about that. We're coming back to BU on the 29th of February. They're bringing me, Jim, Jack, and Dave back. We haven't been back since 1980, so there's going to be a big ceremony honoring us at the BU BC game. So that'll be fun, especially because it's BC, and if you win, it's a double victory. We get together every once in a while. We go to Lake Placid. We have a fantasy camp that we've done the last 5 years. A lot of us are avid golfers. We see each other once in a while. Minnesota kids obviously see each other a lot. I don't see Jimmy. On occasion, I might see Dave Silk. I see Jack O'Callaghan probably more than anybody on the team.
So tell us a little bit about the book, The Making of a Miracle. It's hard in some ways, I imagine, to find new ways to tell this story 40 years on.
Well, the book isn't a lot about the Olympics. A little bit it's about the Olympics, but it's about my life. It's about how I ended up at Boston University, which is a strange occurrence in itself. How I ended up on the Olympic team, which is a strange occurrence in itself. I wrote the book for one reason, and one reason only. I have 5 grandkids now, and I want my grandkids to know that Papa's life wasn't just 2 weeks in Lake Placid. And I talk about growing up in Winthrop, my family, how I grew up, the environment I grew up in, my parents, my cousins, my aunts, my uncles are very much a part of my life. And like I said, you know, 10 or 15 years from now, if I'm long gone, I want my grandkids to know that, you know, Papa didn't score just one goal or play in, you know, one game. He experienced a lot of things in his life.
You mentioned being such a young team at the time, having the college players against the professional players from the Soviet Union. This is a debate that comes up seemingly every 4 years when the Olympics come around. Should NHL players represent their countries in the Olympics, or should it just be amateurs? Where do you come down on that?
Well, first of all, there'll never be amateurs, especially from the European countries. They'll all be professionals. I would love to see the NHL players go back into the Olympic Games. I think the skill level is so good. From all countries now. And the U.S. goes into the tournament now as one of the favorites. We've got some great young players that play in the National Hockey League. And, you know, when it first started, I was curious, would they compete against each other? Would they go hard against each other? Because it's during the season. And you don't want to lose one of your best players, you know, to an injury. But when I saw them compete the first time, I went, wow, they're after each other. They're going to battle. Because when you represent your country, it's different. You know, you're not playing for the Bruins anymore. You're not playing for the Rangers. You're playing for your country. And I think players understand that. And they put aside their differences, and they go out and they compete for their country, because that's the ultimate honor.
Well, we've seen stars like Alex Ovechkin say, whether the NHL lets me go or not, I'm going because I want to play for my country, right? This means a lot to some of these
players. Really does. And I just read recently Connor McDavid and Jack Eichel talked about the fact that Austin Matthews, they want to go. And I hope they go. You know, if they don't go, then we'll send the best team that we can, and I'll still root for them. You know, we're not like the Miami Dolphins. We want to see a gold medal, you know, in this country for men's hockey. It'd be a great tribute to the program and the players themselves.
What do you think about today's game, the pro game in particular? I mean, some of the really big devastating hits that we saw when you were playing. We see fewer of those, largely because the rules have been changed in that way. Do you like that? Do you think it should be more rough and tumble?
No, it's still physical. But, you know, the fourth line now is fourth line of skilled players. You know, I mean, every team that's competing for a Stanley Cup, they're trying to find a good balanced fourth line that can go out there and play. And, you know, the fighter on your roster is not there unless he can flat out play. I just think the skill level is off the charts. They're bigger, they're faster, they're stronger. Today's players are better. And having said that, they're better, and they're coming from all parts of the country now. You know, before they were from Massachusetts, Minnesota, Michigan. You know, now it's all over the world. But even the United States, you know, some of the best players in Florida, Texas, Arizona, California. And you never had players from that area. So I think that sport has grown, and it's great to see it.
So there's the game itself, and there's also the way that it's taught and the way that it's coached, and I'm curious about that. I mean, I don't know Herb Brooks personally, your Olympic coach. My sense of him is that he was a pretty tough coach. And a lot of us were just reading the story in the Sunday Globe about the Assabet Valley girls hockey team and those coaches being suspended for a couple of years by Mass Hockey for what amounts to verbal abuse of their players, or what we think of verbal abuse now, but that perhaps was allowed 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Yeah.
What do you think about that?
I didn't read the article. I hope to try to look at it because a good friend of mine has coached over at Assabet. It's a different era. You can't coach the way the coaches coached in the 70s and 80s. You can still yell at them, but you got to be careful how you do it. And that's the society we live in. Maybe it's the millennials. They just can't handle people getting in their face. But when I played, you heard from it, and Jack Parker would be in your face. But
Jack Parker, the legendary BU coach, of course.
But Jack changed over the years a little. You know, he softened up a little because he saw that today's players are different. But in my years, coaches would grab you. You know, my football coach in high school would grab you by the face mask and twist it. And that's how it was. And you deal with it. You know, if I went home and told my dad, then I'd get a beating from him. So I think coaches have to be a little more careful of what they say and how they say it. And that's the big challenge. It's a fine line. It's not easy being a coach today. And like I said, I haven't read the article. I'm curious what it has to say.
Do you like to see players, especially young players in their teens, advocating for themselves more in that way? Or do you think that on some level they need to toughen up a little bit?
I'm old school, so I think you got to toughen up a little. Now, you know, physical abuse, that's one thing. Verbal abuse, it depends on how it is. You know, if there's some language, then that's a little different story. But you know, coaches got to bring a point across once in a while, and sometimes it's going to be harsh, and sometimes it's going to be demanding, and sometimes it's going to be frank and to the point. Hopefully players can understand that. And one thing about Herb Brooks, he'd criticize you every time you screwed up. And, hey, I know it. I made a mistake. And yell at me the way you want, and hopefully I won't make that mistake again. Now maybe you have to put your arm around the player and talk to him or her and say, look, you made a mistake. Now let's not do this again. So, I'm old school guy, so you're talking to the wrong person when it comes to, you know, coaching in the 2020s or whatever year we're in right now.
So you mentioned earlier trying to sort of block out the whole geopolitical dynamic when you were playing that game in 1980, but you've come to appreciate it all these years later. And I just wonder, are you surprised that 40 years on we're sort of still in this sort of somewhat, I mean, we're not in a literal Cold War, but certainly things are tense between the United States and what's now Russia, of course.
That's the world. That's the world that we live in. It's unfortunate, and hopefully we can get through all this battle that we're going on right now and everybody kind of come together. You know, I'm not a political person. I don't get involved in politics, although I do know, you know, I played golf with President Trump last year, and I've known him a long time, and you know, I think we're going to be invited to the White House, the 80 Olympic team, and it would be a great honor to go to the White House, not necessarily supporting the president, but supporting what the White House is. And I don't know, maybe the next Olympic Games, something will happen, will kind of rally the troops again.
As you know, that's a tough decision that a lot of teams have made in recent years. If they win a championship and they're invited to the White House, do they go? We've seen this be an issue for our local teams because we fortunately win so often. What do you think about that? I mean, should folks just respect the office and go, or should they take a stand?
I'm old school again. I think you respect the office. You know, I remember in 1980, we went to the White House, and a lot of people weren't happy with Jimmy Carter, especially the Olympians, because he boycotted the summer games. So a lot of people were really disappointed. Some, you know, said they weren't going to go because of that reason. But we all went out of respect for the office, not so much sometimes the person that's in it, but what the White House stands for.
So these anniversaries are always kind of an occasion to say, you know, where are they now? What are they up to now? I think for a lot of our listeners, Mike Ruzioni is forever that 20-something-year-old kid from Winthrop who scored the winning goal in the Olympics. What do you want folks to know about Mike Ruzioni today? What are you up to?
I'm still Mike Ruzioni from Winthrop. I'm just 65 and not 25. So, you know, I've been working here at Boston University for, I don't know how many years, it's probably 27, 28 years, although if you added up all the days I've been here, I've probably been here five. I've got a great position here. I love being a director of special outreach. My role here is almost an ambassadorship role here. I meet with students sometimes. I meet with recruits. I meet with alumni. When I'm out in Vegas this weekend, I'm going to do a BU event in Vegas on Sunday morning. It's going to be brunch with me. And we've got about 20, 25 alums that are going to come to it. And so things like that. It's like I said, it's almost an ambassadorship role, and I love it. And I still do a lot of motivational speaking. I travel quite a bit around the country doing some talks. So got five grandkids now, so life's moving on in a different direction. So all is good. All is fun.
Mike Ruzioni, thank you so much for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
That was our chat with Mike Ruzioni yesterday. He mentioned his familiarity with President Trump and is actually at the president's rally in Vegas today. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, and Paris Alston. Tim Sko is our technical director, with engineering by Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Atesh Hathi. I'm Callum Borchers. Join us Monday for more Radio Boston.